This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Maybe you've already heard the news. It came down a couple weeks ago.
It's official. Governor Newsom signed a bill that will allow college athletes to earn money from endorsement deals while still in college.
The Fair Pay to Play Act, signed by Gavin Newsom on The Shop, a show produced by LeBron James.
Lawmakers from Washington to Florida say they're either already pushing or plan to propose similar legislation.
Governor Gavin Newsom expects the NCAA to challenge the law, but says it will be tough to fight California.
Can't afford to lose. State of California, it's truly a nation state, and the economic consequences of it would be profound.
But maybe you didn't hear this part. The man who signed the bill that just might lead to the dismantling of that cartel better known as the NCAA is a former scholarship athlete. Here he is on the podcast The Lead from The Athletic.
It shaped me. I love sports. I don't like sports. I love sports. It's the reason we're having this conversation. It's the reason I'm governor of California.
California Governor Gavin Newsom sat down with reporter Olivia Christian.
Tell me about how baseball found you, or how you found baseball.
I would not be sitting here without baseball. I was one of those kids that every single night my mom would have to turn off the radio because I was falling asleep. Forgive me, Dodger fans, but listening to the San Francisco Giants broadcast, I was obsessed with baseball.
Gavin Newsom's obsession was mostly directed at a single player, a Bay Area hero from the baby era of the late 80s.
I found these old VHS tapes, and no one will know who the heck this is, but Will Clark was one of my baseball heroes.
No one's going to know who that is.
I don't know. In some parts of the country. But Will Clark had one of the sweetest swings in baseball, just one of the purest swings. And I used to videotape every single at-bat. Now, this is back when you couldn't fast-forward or you couldn't. I mean, it was like, and you know, unlike DVDs, this old
That's
VHS.
Passion.
I have like 3 or 4 seasons of every single Will Clark at-bat. That's how damn obsessed I was.
Does Will Clark know you have these
videos?
In
fact, one of the great gifts was someone told Will Clark this. It's about, I'm not making this up, about 90 days ago, 3 months ago, and Will sent me a selfie photo, and then they surprised me with a little video, which was very fun.
Newsom was a student of the game, but he really struggled at being a student in the classroom.
I had severe learning disability, dyslexia, and I grew up as the kid in the back of the classroom, my head down, and had no confidence whatsoever, was struggling in school. But for some reason, maybe being a little taller, left-handed, I started excelling a little bit in baseball.
Athletes, especially those who play team sports, often describe themselves as being shaped by their sport. They wouldn't be the individual they are had they not played that game. In what way exactly has baseball shaped you as a person?
Patience, perspective, setbacks, triumphs. This was early in my baseball career. I was playing right field, and anyone listening knows sports knows what that means. So I was that kid. I played for Round Table Pizza, and that's not an ad, just a fact. Guy Maurice Bignan, I remember, he struck me out 3 times and was embarrassed, devastated. And I went home. I had a single mom raise me. I lost her to cancer almost 20 years ago now. She was, as a mother, devastated, so she brought me back to the field later that night, and she pitched to me over and over and over again. True story. This is, God is my witness. I played against that same team a few weeks later. Maurice Bignan pitched again. I hit a damn home run. I cannot tell you how that experience shaped my life, shaped my deep admiration and respect for my mother and what she was about. It shaped my ability to think about, you have tough times, you have setbacks, and you're demoralized, that you can come back and triumph, but you got to work hard. That's baseball. That's life.
By high school, the kid who once sat in the back of the class with his head down, who had fallen asleep listening to Giants games, saw his passion and dedication to the sport begin to pay off.
Some of the great moments of my life were meeting actual scouts from professional baseball teams, keeping their cards. I still have them. I have an old box with my name on it, Gavin's box, that was in my mom's storage, and it was all the original cards and all the original letters that we got from college campuses. If I had 5 extra minutes, I'd be in the backyard shooting basketballs or throwing a ball against the wall. It was an extraordinary gift to be part of team sports.
Newsom was a left-handed pitcher who dreamed about playing in the majors. But first came college.
Would love to lie and say, well, I was a Rhodes Scholar and, you know, got 18,000 on my SATs. You don't even want to know what I got on my SAT.
No one's gonna, everyone's going to start Googling what your SATs are.
Yeah, trust me, it's distressing. I would not have gotten into Santa Clara University had it not been for a baseball scholarship. There was no way to do that academically. I was going to go to a junior college.
But the reality of playing baseball on this next level quickly set in.
College sports took my love of baseball away. It was work. A requirement to do all the voluntary classes and then the workouts and then the weekend and then summer league and then winter. I mean, it came a job almost. And ultimately had an ulnar nerve issue throughout my arm and had a surgery and really didn't come back. And then I had to make that tough choice of what the hell do I do with my life? Because I was just so consumed by baseball.
Newsom said he felt like an imposter on campus. He believed he didn't belong there, if not for what he called the privilege of a past that was baseball. So he decided to spend a semester abroad.
I went to Rome, of all places, and I came back a completely different person. I mean, it was decompression for me and allowed me to think about a life outside of sports.
When you left campus, when you walked off Santa Clara University's steps, did you leave with that feeling of, I need to change this? Or did this come about later on in your life?
Came about later on. I mean, I've always focused on athletics.
After a few years in the wine business, Newsom was appointed to the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. And after serving three terms, he was elected mayor of the city in 2003 and again in 2007. He became California's lieutenant governor in 2010 and was reelected in 2014. And during all these years, while he was rising in politics, he met athletes who shared similar stories.
You know, I'm a social justice warrior. That's been like, if you ask me my why, not just professionally, but personally, it's to stand up for ideals and strike out against injustice. I'm kind of a Sarge Shriver Democrat. So I was born and raised, and I got to know Marshawn Lynch.
Oh, look at this run. What a run. Marshawn Lynch still on his feet. He's dancing his way for the touchdown.
Marshawn started talking to me about his experience at UC Berkeley and how real his educational, quote-unquote, experience was as a student versus an athlete. And you just think, these kids, almost the overwhelming majority of these Division I football and basketball players, and 98% are never drafted.
Right.
Not even drafted. Forget being successful in these fancy leagues. They're not even drafted in women's sports. There's not even that opportunity, with rare exceptions. So I know that there's sort of this romantic view of the world that, well, they're treated like royalty and, you know, we pay for their scholarship and they get all the attention and things. But they also sacrifice an extraordinary amount and they don't have that full experience that so many others are privileged to have at universities and college campuses across the country.
Newsom started focusing on what he calls the injustice that is being done to kids. Kids that he believes are fed false promises that somehow they're all going to go pro.
It all came to the fore for me about 7 years ago when UC Berkeley came out with the lowest graduation rates for football players in the Power Five conferences, 44%. Basketball was 38%. UC Berkeley, the finest, arguably, public education that you can get. Maybe UCLA can argue that they're right up there. And the lowest graduation rates.
As lieutenant governor, Newsom served on the Board of Regents, the governing board of the University of California.
We approve the athletic director contracts. We approve the coaching contracts. The highest paid employees in the state of California, public employees, are coaches. So I started reviewing coaches' contracts and realized all the incentives were for athletic behavior. None were for student behavior. Now, if the notion is it's students first, athletes second, student athlete, it seemed rather backwards, and NC2A fought us on the modest reforms I was trying to argue for as a member of the Regents. Every way, shape, or form. Slow walked us, put together another work group, a commission. I got to know Mark Emmert, the head of the NC2A, as a consequence of this. We had a very good working relationship. He pledged and promised and promoted, but it led me to believe that they're not going to change unless they're forced to change.
What were some of the things you were hearing from them? What were some more of the arguments they were making against it?
That we got this. We understand these concerns. Well, of course, we're working on that. We have a work group on that. We're coming out next year with recommendations. Oh, no, as you know, this has always been our top priority. Thank you for bringing up the obvious. We'll certainly get back to you. I mean, it's the usual stuff. It's the pablum. And then I started learning more about the O'Bannon case. And, of course, as a kid growing up, loving college basketball, not just college baseball.
The O'Bannon brothers.
Right?
They were huge.
Legends.
Yeah.
Ed O'Bannon was the star of a UCLA team that won the NCAA championship in 1995.
During his day, if you saw number 31 in a Bruins uniform, you knew it was Ed O'Bannon. He just didn't expect to see a player with that jersey and his likeness in a video game.
In 2009, Ed became the lead plaintiff in the O'Bannon versus NCAA lawsuit, a case.
I realized that I hadn't been compensated and or even told that I was going to be on this video game. And I just thought that that was wrong.
And then I'm reading more and more about other college athletes' experiences and the exploitation. And, you know, started looking at one common denominator. A lot of these are black athletes. A lot of these coaches are white coaches. And I'll be honest with you, that left me raw as well. And so I'm seeing a system that's making billions and billions of dollars a year in the aggregate. I'm seeing these athletes that are not even getting a real education, even if they get a degree. They sure as hell don't have, excuse my language, but the real campus experience everybody else has. And none of them are working just 20 hours a week, which is what the rules say. I started thinking, maybe this system's a little exploited. And maybe as a fan, maybe we should really think about what we're cheering on and maybe, you know, look under the hood a little bit.
But there's been some pushback about the feasibility, the validity, and whether or not reforming college sports should be a legislative priority.
You know, look, we have a million issues to focus on. And by the way, our critics say, well, focus on homelessness. And when you solve that, you could tell us how to do our job. I get all that sort of machismo thing. And it is usually machismo. Let's also establish that as a frame of consideration and reference. But the legislature was inclined to be supportive of reforms. But Senator Nancy Skinner, she had the courage a year ago to introduce some pretty audacious legislation that went much farther than a basic Bill of Rights for our student athletes and went to the broader issue of name, image, and likeness. And I got to tell you, the prospect that we'd be sitting here today and that she got that down to my desk and I signed it, I would have given that 10-15% chance a year and a half ago. It is a remarkable thing that she was able to accomplish with her colleagues, where they were able to make the case not only to their Democratic colleagues, but this was a bipartisan bill.
California Senate Bill 206, the Fair Pay to Play Act, does not mandate that players be paid by their schools or the NCAA. It allows student athletes the opportunity to profit from their own name and likeness and to sign endorsement deals. But that can't happen until 2023, and only if the bill survives in the courts.
All right, well, let's do it.
You ready?
Yeah, let's do it, man.
All right.
It's now law in California.
I'm thinking about that signing of the bill, what I saw on Twitter.
Yeah.
That video. You were sitting in a barber's chair looking at LeBron James and his boys. Were they trying to talk you into getting a fade?
Yeah, no, well, he did. I mean, LeBron did try to get me to get a haircut.
He line you up in the back?
No, that wasn't going to work here. trust me, especially with this hair.
Tell me how that scene came about.
Well, full disclosure, my wife is not a fan of LeBron's. She's obsessed with LeBron James.
I was worried about where you were going with that.
No. You have no idea. I'm talking about, I know everyone's like LeBron James' number one fan. You have to imagine the number one fan, the most extreme, multiply that by infinity. You now have a picture of my wife.
One day, a few years ago, Newsom was on vacation.
And this guy starts rolling up in a golf cart. And I'm like, no, can't be. It is. It's LeBron James. And I was that guy. I became that guy. I'm like, sir, I it's my wife's, I'm sorry, I know everyone does this to you, but my wife's birthday, and if you could just do me a favor, and I thought he'd walk away, and he probably should have, because I was just that crazy fan guy. And he graciously stopped, said, what's her name? He says, what's her birthday? And then he just did this whole video thing.
Aww.
And I said, well, I know this is crazy, but, you know, she's having her birthday tonight just right over there. And I don't know if you have anything else to do.
The guy
shows up at the birthday, surprises my damn wife. So I'm husband of the damn year.
Now
I'm the biggest LeBron James fan, despite being a Warriors fan that has to square that circle. Anyway, I've gotten to really appreciate the work he's done for schools and the sincerity to which I think he deeply cares about his community and his legacy beyond sports. And he has better understanding of this than 99% of us, because he's a mentor to so many of these athletes. And for those that do go to college that never make it to the pros, you know, it breaks his heart to see them, you know, working in a car wash when they were out there selling jerseys and their universities were making millions of dollars off their name and likeness, and they didn't get a damn penny.
Newsom also got to know Maverick Carter, LeBron's longtime friend and business partner. And it was his idea to have Newsom sign the bill on the set of The Shop, the HBO show that features LeBron and Carter in conversation with athletes and other celebrities. Guests have included Candace Parker, Seth Rogen, Draymond Green, Ice Cube, Drake, and LeBron's former teammate, Kevin Love.
And I thought, you know what? Politicians were so rote and cliched, signing bills, ceremony. You've seen the pictures at the desk, and I hand the pen to the author, and we take a smiley photograph, and everyone rolls their eyes, and we move on to the next bill. And I thought that could be fun. And what a great conversation we had, their unique experiences and perspectives, and then the politician, the odd man out with his Adidas on when they were all wearing Nikes.
What?
Anyway, they brought that up.
Supporters applaud this effort as a first step that could finally push the NCAA to allow compensation for student athletes. But not everyone supports the measure.
People, I know some have argued, some coaches have actually said, it's unconscionable for a governor to get involved in our business. Well, you know, how dare they say that? This is our business. Students, which they allege is their priority, student athletes, that's the business we're in. I'm the president now of the UC Regents, and that's why I worry about these kids. And I really do worry about them because I don't think we do justice to really caring about them once they're no longer useful for us, the adults that are able, in some cases, respectfully, institutionally, to exploit them.
That's California Governor Gavin Newsom speaking with reporter Olivia Christian. New York City mobster Arnold Rothstein often gets the credit for fixing the 1919 World Series. But it wasn't his idea. It was brought to him by a Boston gambler named Joseph Sports Sullivan.
Rothstein knew that if Sullivan comes to you with a deal, he knows what he's talking about, and he's capable of pulling it off.
That story is coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Think of NPR's Life Kit as that friend who always has great advice about everything from how to invest to how to get a great workout. We bring you tools to help you get it together. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit All Guides.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
I believe he wasn't educated on the situation at hand, and he spoke. So many people could have been harmed, not only financially, but physically, emotionally, spiritually. So just be careful what we tweet and we say.
That was LeBron James wading into the international incident involving the NBA, China, and a tweet from Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Karen. Thrilled to be here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, Michael, you're up.
You know, before he ever put on an NBA uniform, LeBron James, he entered the league with expectations that he'd not only be good, but he had to be great. And as his career progressed and his stature within the league and among all-time greats became secure, James became more outspoken. He publicly endorsed presidential candidates. He called Donald Trump a bum. And in some ways, he sort of raised the bar for what is expected of him. Some people thought he'd be like some new moderate Muhammad Ali in terms of mobilizing people and opening their eyes and awareness to social issues. This week, we got to see the limits of that activism. Many expected him to come out and either, you know, show a support for Morey or speak out against China or do something. And he stumbled badly. He took a position that seemed that he was aligned with China and put money ahead of principle. But I always wonder, like, is it fair? have we reached a point where expectations for LeBron exceed what he's even capable of?
Charlotte?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, right? I think that we're asking basketball players and, you know, GMs and coaches to be like geopolitical experts.
Right.
And I don't totally understand what the point of that is. Like, yes, it might be unfair to have expectations of him to be, you know, a leader off the court to the extent that some people do expect of him. But his seeming not to support the fight going on in Hong Kong for, you know, democracy, basically, that felt like a big misstep. It felt like there were ways he could have avoided the issue or not commented rather than speaking about it in a way that did feel very pro-China. But I don't think it's irreparable. Like, I don't think his saying that negates all the other things he's fought for during his career and will probably continue to fight for. And I don't know. I think it's been really interesting to see how this has all unfolded. And it was definitely unfortunate and disappointing that he said that. But I don't see this as wiping his past work away.
Yeah. So I had this weird analogy pop into my head as I was thinking through all of this, as I often do. I'm sorry, I have a weird analogy head. But have you ever found yourself saying something like, I'm sorry, but you're stepping on my toe? And then the person says, that's okay, as if it was somehow your fault that they were stepping on your toe. I feel like that's what's happened here to LeBron. Like when Daryl Morey tweeted his pseudo non-apology, he said, quote, I have had a lot of opportunities since that tweet to hear and consider other perspectives. And it seems like LeBron took that at face value. Like, okay, here's this guy admitting that he didn't know what he was talking about. Hmm. But that's not how I took Maury's tweet at all. I just see it as a guy trying to get China to stop stomping on his toes. But I'm wondering, these NBA stars, not just LeBron, but James Harden also spoke out, and really anyone who's got major endorsement deals in China, they must have a completely different experience of China than the rest of us do. I mean, they're so revered there, and they're so well compensated there. That's got to affect how they see the country, right, Michael?
Yeah, I think it does, and I think that they only get to see one view of it. I mean, they're not going to take them to areas where people are being, you know, held in, you know, prisons or right. anything like that. You know, right. they're going to go to arenas, go to gyms and have people praise them. They're going to sell a shoe and you know, make money and things like that. And I wonder if he even thought it through that, you know, he didn't necessarily have to say anything. Like you said, he could have just said, you know, I don't feel comfortable speaking on this subject. And, you know, maybe when I do, I will. And that may not have been enough for people, but I also feel like his words carry a lot of weight. So if he was to speak out against China, he could hurt Nike. He could hurt the NBA yeah. and the earning potential of people domestically who, you know, are able to profit because of that kind of sketchy relationship, business relationship that all companies have with China.
Michael, I want to pick up on something that Charlotte said, which is, like, LeBron James has so many well-considered opinions on so many important things. Is this one point of view irreparable? Is it going to be thrown in his face for the next decade, the way the decision has been all these years?
It's possible, but for him to bounce back, it's going to have to be something that he does probably on the court to get people to forget about what he said. But I think for some people, they'll probably be hurt, you know, for a long time.
All right, Charlotte, you're next.
The NBA season is starting very soon. For Sports Illustrated, I wrote a profile of 76ers coach Brett Brown. Michael, you're in Philly, right?
Yes.
All right. So Brett Brown has been the coach of the Sixers for 7 years now. Sam Hinkie, who is the general manager who started the whole tanking process, known as the process, hired Brown because he had the perfect mix of experience in the NBA under coach Greg Popovich with the Spurs. He'd been a head coach in Australia for 17 years before that. He was a guy who was really, really good at developing players. And the process went on a lot longer than people thought it would. Brown told me it was like getting your teeth punched in every night. Oof. But in the last two seasons, Brown has had some success with his teams. I mean, with the draft picks they had, they got Joel Embiid, they got Ben Simmons, two All-Stars. And this year, it's looking like they have a chance to win a championship. What I find so fascinating about Brown is that no coach has ever, or hardly any that I know of, has ever survived a tank and then gone on to win a championship. Usually you have the guy who's like the sacrificial lamb where, you know, they come in, they suffer through losing, they get fired, and another guy comes in like Tony Dungy with the Bucks, and then John Gruden comes on in and he wins in his first year with the team.
Right.
And so what I think the question now is can Brown do this?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a chance to talk to Brett, you know, about, you know, the turnaround and how he was able to even stay motivated through the process. I mean, they had a year where they won 10 games, and that had to be a miserable experience for anybody.
So brutal.
But everyone who I spoke to about him and, you know, players, coaches, they all understood what the objective was. You know, they were trying to build a culture and establish a culture. And that all started with Brett because of his positivity. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really a remarkable story, like you said, that now he's in a position where the expectations are that they're one of the favorites to win a championship. I don't know if this is the team that's going to get it done, but I know that he's going to give everything he has to try to see it through. And that's one thing you can admire about him, because he's definitely a fighter. You don't go through a 10-win season and then turn around and get 50 wins back-to-back years if you're not one.
Charlotte, I got to say my gut reaction to this whole thing is pretty similar to yours. Like, they're doing it wrong. Everybody knows that this is not how you tank. You tank for a bunch of years, and then when you've got a team, you bring in a new coach that revitalizes the group dynamic and signals that you're ready to be contenders. Like, everybody knows that's how it works. But the interesting thing here is that usually after a team tanks for a long time, like, that group dynamic is just broken, and the group dynamic doesn't seem to be broken here. But if the season starts and the 76ers lose a bunch of games, are fans really going to stick with him, or are they going to be calling for his head because, you know, Philly?
Well, if you ask Philly fans, they'll tell you that the team wins every game and Brett Brown loses every game. So I remember last year, it was like, so whatever the record was, it was maybe 52-30. It was like Sixers won 52 games and Brett Brown lost 30.
That is so true. Oh, he was very open about that. He was like, you know, Philly fans are tough, but I love it. Like, yeah. I think it's an interesting question of whether, you know, is getting rid of a coach always the best move? And I don't actually think so. I think it often seems sort of like a band-aid as opposed to a cure to me if you have a guy who's proven to understand his players the way he does. So I hope he makes it. I want to hear more of Brett Brown and his Maine accent at his press conferences.
I call it the Australian accent.
That's what Tim Duncan called it, too.
Because he's got this New England thing going and the Australia. You put it together, and like sometimes you listen to him speak, and you're like, wait, what did he just say?
You know, I know a lot has been made about the process and the length of time that it took for the final decision to be made on who's going to coach the Philadelphia 76ers.
Right, you're like, where is this guy from? I really hope he can do it.
Yeah.
I think he's a really creative coach. I think that if he does have a consistent group of guys this year, he's going to be able to find the best way they work together. And, you know, I think it would be really fun to see this work. I think it would be historic, and I think it would make a lot of people really happy, honestly.
Okay, so last Saturday morning, I woke up to the news that the two-hour marathon barrier had been broken by Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya. A sub-two-hour marathon is blazing fast, about 4.5 minutes per mile. For years, as world record marathon times have inched closer and closer to the two-hour mark, there's been this debate. Can a human run 26.2 miles in less than 2 hours? And there were those who said that it could not be done. Here's how we did it. First, it wasn't really a race. This was an event designed specifically for the sub-2-hour attempt. The course was flat, it was straight, it was near sea level. I'm not going to say it was easy, but for a marathon course, it was pretty good. The event was scheduled to take place during an 8-day window for the best weather. Kipchoge was surrounded by pace setters who rotated in and out and ran in a formation that had been designed by aerodynamic experts and tested in wind tunnels. It even had a name. They called it the Open V. The group was guided by a pace car that projected a green laser grid that mapped out the exact most efficient line to run. Oh, and Kipchoge and the whole lot were wearing these new prototype shoes scientifically shown to reduce marathon times. So, look, what Kipchoge did was amazing, and anyone who says it's not is just crazy, but it was also a highly branded marketing event, and I'm kind of glad I slept through it because I think I would have had a hard time cheering it on. Charlotte?
That's interesting. I guess my feeling is if anyone can run a marathon in under 2 hours, I don't really care what the circumstances are because, like, I can't run a 4:30 for, I don't know, 50 yards, let alone a mile, let alone 26.2. So the human feat of this is super cool to me. The one thing I wonder, though, is, like, is there a point at which you can't get faster, or will technology keep allowing people to just keep breaking? Like, a towel has a saturation point. Like, is there a saturation point for how fast a person can run? Because, like, you probably can't run a marathon in like 30 minutes, but like, where is that limit?
I thought it was an amazing accomplishment, no matter the circumstances, no matter how it was set up. I was doing the math. I was trying to figure out, you know, the average per mile. I was like, yo, he kept that same pace.
Yeah.
That means he sprinted for 26 miles. I'm like, that is just unbelievable. Like, when you do something that hasn't ever been done by anyone, we should just sit back and just praise it.
The interesting thing to me, the thing I've been thinking about, a lot of people compared this to, you know, breaking the 4-minute mile mark. And I remember I did a story on the anniversary of the 4-minute mile. And by that time, like, high schoolers were running 4-minute miles.
Yeah.
And so I do think one day, you know, maybe 50 years from now, maybe 70 years from now, we'll be looking at this 2-hour mark and say, that's not such a big deal. But it is really an accomplishment. I do think there will be a limit at some point. I just don't know when that's going to be.
I'm going to do the 15-minute marathon.
Could you even do that in your car? That's what's,
no,
you know.
Definitely. I mean, if you hit traffic, no.
Forget it. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. And on our latest episode, we're exploring anger, what it is when you feel it, whether some get to feel it more openly than others, and why. Listen now.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the milestone birthday the NBA refuses to acknowledge. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Washington, D.C. will host a World Series for the first time since 1933, when the Senators played the New York Giants. And the Nationals are looking pretty good heading to their first fall classic, don't you think?
Yes, and I'm revolted by the very concept, because you just know that the World Series is going to be plagued by beltway phonies and leapers upon the bandwagon of both parties. Washington's had two tries at a baseball team. It's failed both times. The Expos should have just kept right going and been in Havana, but that's a painful period of my life I don't like to discuss. So I am rooting for anybody who plays the Nationals, and I'm rooting for a 4-game sweep, and I'm rooting for a whole bunch of people who learned about baseball 15 minutes ago to have their hearts broken. I'm just a curmudgeon on this one. I'm
you
sorry.
You really are. Well, speaking of shark suits, the Nationals have a secret weapon, and it's this. So it all started back in June. Reserve outfielder Gerardo Parra was in a slump. He thought a new walk-up song would help. He says he tried merengue, he tried hip-hop, but he settled on Baby Shark because it was his 2-year-old daughter's favorite, and it's kind of become a thing, right?
Well, good for his daughter, you know? I mean, but by the end of the World Series, especially if it goes 7 games, we're all going to be cursing the Disney radio channel. We really are.
Well, 4 teams have never made the Stanley Cup Finals, 4 teams have never made the Super Bowl, 6 teams have never made the NBA Finals, but there's just one team that has never made it to the World Series, and that team is...
The Seattle Mariners, who have had several great seasons and certainly have had enough talent to go to the World Series, but they just haven't been able to make it. They've only been in the playoffs 4 times.
Yeah.
But... that's kind of a landmark you don't want on your franchise, right?
To be the last team standing. That's right. Just sad.
Yes, and you know that the first time they get there, they're going out in 4 games. I mean, you absolutely know that. That's the biggest lock of all.
Charlie, 6,776 home runs were hit in the 2019 regular season. I did not misspeak. 6,776. And experts, including you, were convinced that the ball was juiced. But through last Sunday, home runs were down 50% in the postseason. So can we now say the ball has been unjuiced?
Well, something's happening for sure. I mean, it's not the weather. The weather's been more than fine. And certainly not the teams. The Yankees are still the same deadly lineup they were all year. It's got to be the ball. I mean, it just has to be.
Well, Major League Baseball, of course, insists this is all hooey. They say the postseason baseballs are taken from the same stock as the regular season balls, and the only difference is the postseason stamp. What did they do? Use lead ink?
I don't know what that's even supposed to mean. But the thing is that analytics is the way we are proving that the people in Major League Baseball are lying their hindquarters off. Because Mike Schilt, the manager of the Cardinals, said his team's analytics department said the ball's carrying 4.5 feet shorter than it did during the regular season. And that really is the difference between a home run or an extra base hit and an out.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell has spoken, Charlie, and you'll be happy to hear that there is absolutely no evidence of NFL teams tanking for draft picks. Do you think the commissioner has tuned into a Dolphins game yet this season?
It's really kind of sad for the Dolphins because the commissioner is implying that they just really stink. And that no matter how hard they try, they're just not an NFL team this year. Wouldn't you rather have the reputation of actually doing something to get your team better than to have the commissioner say, I'm sorry, there's no evidence that these guys are anything but completely incompetent?
London's Wembley Stadium seats 90,000 people, and the English Football Association has confirmed that next month's friendly between England and Germany has been completely sold out. What's the big deal?
Well, I mean, it's a women's game. I mean, that's what the big deal is, and it's really quite something. And Wembley, of course, is an iconic ground, so it's even more significant that the women's team sold it out.
The previous attendance record for the Lionesses, which is what England calls their women's team, was 45,619.
But so this would be more then.
This would be more, right. Okay. But, you know, women's soccer only growing in the U.S.,
that's
nowhere
right.
else.
No place else, exactly.
And finally, Charlie, Lee Ann Walker played her last full season on the LPGA Tour in 2008. She returned to competition and promptly set what might be a world record, but not the good kind, right?
In the interim, the rule was changed where you can't have your caddy stand behind you when you putt. And apparently this was quite a regular occurrence back in the day, which isn't that long ago, by the way. And so she had her caddy and then discovered that it was not legal anymore and had to call penalties, and she had to add 42 penalty shots to a round, which in the first round means she shot a 127, with which I can sympathize completely, by the way. Although she didn't, the great thing is when I shoot a 127, I have to swing the club 127 times. She didn't have to do that.
Good for her.
So it's exactly, she found a way to shoot 127 without exhausting herself.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Make sure you never miss Charlie Pierce cracking a joke or yelling
sports
by subscribing to the Only a Game podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. With the World Series around the corner, we turn to the Fall Classic. No, not this year's Fall Classic. I'm talking about the one between the Chicago White Sox and the Cincinnati Reds that took place 100 years ago this month. As you may have heard, it was fixed. The fallout became known as the Black Sox scandal. Shoeless Joe Jackson became the man most closely associated with the scandal, say it ain't so, Joe, and all that. Meanwhile, the Boston gambler who put the fix in motion, Joseph Sport Sullivan, remains largely in the shadows. WBUR's Shira Springer has the story.
I'm in a small elevator at the Hotel Buckminster in Boston. We're going to the sixth floor. We're going to see the room. When the doors open, we step into a dark, narrow corridor. The hotel and its triangular floor plan is more than 120 years old, and it feels like we've entered a maze. We head right, then the hotel's sales manager, Zach Byron, realizes we need to turn around. We almost walk right by the room. From the outside, there's nothing special about it. Byron opens the door.
This is room 615.
The inside is pretty unremarkable, too, except for the view. From a small space with a couch and a coffee table, we can see Fenway Park in all its glory. Well, mostly the backside of the Green Monster. But it's still Fenway, and somehow the view feels special, strangely intimate, like we've been given a backstage pass. On September 18, 1919, gambler Joseph Sport Sullivan and White Sox first baseman Chick Gandel looked out at the same view from the same hotel windows. Or, as Byron says,
this is where the scandal was hatched, and we're standing right where a table would have been, where the scandal participants would have sat.
It was here, In room 615, where according to Elliot Azanoff's book, Eight Men Out, Gandel told Sullivan, "I think we can put it in the bag." The basic idea? Pay a group of White Sox players to throw the 1919 World Series. But who was Sport Sullivan, the man who helped hatch the biggest scandal in baseball history? How did he get in the middle of it, then essentially get away with it? Back then, there was a good chance you would find Sullivan's distinctive figure in the gamblers section at Fenway Park. Yes, Fenway had a gamblers section in the right field pavilion. Betting took place in full view of everyone, including policemen who did little, if anything, to stop it. Sport Sullivan was 6 feet tall, whip smart, confident, charismatic, and unquestionably stylish.
He was called Sport, by the way, not because he bet on sports games, but because he dressed as a sport. He was a very neat, expensive dresser, you know, $1,000 Brooks Brothers suits type of guy.
History professor and book author Bruce Allardyce is a White Sox fan from Chicago who's written more about Sullivan's life than anyone else.
He was nationally known, not just to the players, but to the gambling fraternity as the go-to man in Boston. He was, among other things, an early sabermetrician before people really paid attention to baseball statistics. He was a baseball expert, a legitimate baseball expert.
Sullivan was also a math whiz with a remarkable memory. He could keep track of 30 bets at a time without writing them down. He could calculate payouts in his head. He also paid players for inside information about injuries and starting pitchers. And Boston ace Cy Young said Sullivan tried to bribe him and his catcher to throw at least one game of the 1903 World Series. The pitcher told a sports reporter that when he heard the offer, he punched Sullivan in the jaw. That wasn't the only time Sullivan suffered some unpleasant consequences.
You know, he was arrested several times for gambling, but always paid the fine and was back in the ballpark the next day.
And back to the gamblers section at Fenway, or the one at Boston's other major league ballpark, Braves Field.
In the early 20th century, Boston was considered the hub of baseball betting activity.
Jacob Pomeranke chairs the Black Sox Scandal Research Committee for Sabre, the Society for American Baseball Research.
Both the Braves and the Red Sox had many problems with gamblers getting involved and trying to alter the outcome of games leading up to the 1919 World Series.
This was the baseball climate where Sullivan thrived and made friends with players. The better the friend, the better the inside information.
That's part of Sports Sullivan's modus operandi. He'd invite visiting teams, and of course the Red Sox also, to shoot pool with him at the bar, have a drink at some local restaurant or something like that, or spend a day relaxing at his country house.
Once, Sullivan brought a group of White Sox players to his house for an all-night card game.
The players knew they were sort of being set up to be used, but that was the style of baseball. He was not the only gambler doing these things at that time.
White Sox first baseman Chick Gandel first met Sullivan in 1912, 7 years before that meeting at the Hotel Buckminster. It was a long, profitable friendship built on Gandel feeding Sullivan inside information. But fixing the World Series was something else entirely. They figured it would take some serious cash to get a group of White Sox players on board. $80,000, or the equivalent of $1.2 million in today's money. Sullivan knew he couldn't finance it alone. Enter Arnold Rothstein. The notorious New York City mobster often gets credit for pulling off the fix. That's probably because a thinly veiled fictional version of Rothstein, a character named Meyer Wolfsheim, appears in The Great Gatsby.
He's the man who fixed the World Series back in 1919.
Fixed the World Series? How did he happen to do that?
He just saw the opportunity.
Why isn't he in jail?
They can't get him, old sport. He's a smart man.
But really, Rothstein didn't come up with the idea. He just bankrolled it.
Rothstein knew that if Sullivan comes to you with a deal, he knows what he's talking about, and he's capable of pulling it off.
Sullivan headed to Chicago with $80,000 for the eight players now in on the fix, plus more money for placing bets. While he was there,
he went to the Chamber of Commerce and got a list of who in the Chamber of Commerce was likely to bet on baseball games, and made private bets with them. See, rather than going public in a hotel and everything like that.
But Sullivan and Rothstein weren't the only gamblers in on the fix. See, the players wanted more money for throwing games. And between the time Sullivan and Gandel first conspired at the Hotel Buckminster and the time Sullivan arrived in Chicago, the players had brokered other deals with other gamblers. The problem? The more people in on the fix, the more likely word would get out. The White Sox entered the Fall Classic heavy favorites against the Cincinnati Reds, but they lost the 9-game series 5-3. Rumors swirled about a fix. By September 1920, almost a year after that meeting in Room 615, players and gamblers were talking to reporters and testifying before a Cook County grand jury in Chicago. Talking to the Little Sun newspaper, Sullivan vowed to testify. He didn't want to become the scapegoat in the scandal. He told the paper,
"I have the whole history of the deal from beginning to end. I will tell the grand jury or any other officials the whole inside story of the frame-up."
But Sullivan never went before the grand jury. The prevailing theory? Rothstein exerted his influence to keep Sullivan off the stand. Even after Rothstein died, Sullivan never told his side of the Black Sox scandal. Sullivan was banned from ballparks. His math skills, remarkable memory, and pricey suits faded. Sullivan died at 78, almost 30 years after he helped hatch the biggest scandal in baseball history. Again, Pomeranke.
You know, one of the reasons that we consider Sport Sullivan to be one of the biggest missing links about the Black Sox scandal is that he took a lot of his secrets to the grave with him when he died in 1949.
Still, Sullivan gets remembered at the Hotel Buckminster in his hometown of Boston. There's a plaque in the lobby that commemorates the meeting between Sullivan and Gandel in Room 615. That's where I am when I ask hotel sales manager Zach Byron if guests ever request to stay where the Black Sox scandal was hatched.
Occasionally, we get some real baseball aficionados who are really familiar with the whole story, but that's maybe 3 or 4 times a year. The vast majority of people who stay here have no idea. There's a story here at the Buckminster, it's kind of like a local legend, that up on the 6th floor, you can occasionally, if you're walking by yourself late at night, you can occasionally feel somebody kind of walking behind you. And some of our guests, totally independent of each other, have told us that they'll do a quick turnaround and look, and they see a man in a sport coat with a vest and a fedora walking around. Some people have claimed that they've seen him in this room itself. Some people say it's Sport walking around. Who knows?
Maybe after 100 years, Joseph Sport Sullivan wants to be more than a missing link. Or maybe he just likes the view from Room 615.
That's WBUR's Shira Springer. And thanks to the voice talent who helped us out with this story, Jack Lepiarz, Alex Schneps, and Paul Vikas. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.